This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details.
This is episode 16, but we recorded it 17th in June 2023.
Welcome to By Hook or By Crook, the Prisoner podcast, or the UFO cast does the Prisoner, whatever we ended up deciding to call it at the end. It was By Hook or By Crook. I am Michael. You probably know from the Tin Dog podcast, but more importantly, my colleague in this is Luke.
More importantly, I don't think I'm more important than you, Michael.
You do the editing. Of course you're more important.
I do the editing, yes.
And you actually know who the actors are. So.
Yeah, but that's not massively important. That just...
Who doesn't know who the actors are.
Well, as I was saying to our guest before you turned up, Spot the Doctor Who actor this week is well, we will have to talk about it briefly, but yeah. There isn't really anybody to spot because of the nature of this episode.
That's true.
So you won't have to embarrass yourself by not knowing anything, Michael.
Excellent.
Because there isn't anything to know.
Ah, but you've just gone ahead and mentioned our guest, who, as always, I don't know who it is. So who is this week's number three?
Hi, my name is Pete. I'm from the Isle of Man, from Devon originally. Been living here for about 20 odd years for my sins, and loving it. It's a lovely, lovely place. And I'm happy to come here and talk about The Prisoner and my love of it, and hopefully contribute some anecdotes of mine to the episode we're focusing on today.
Excellent. Now, we usually start off by saying a couple of things. First off, why this episode?
Okay. Well, I must say, originally, when I first watched The Prisoner, the first time I ever watched it, Fallout was probably my favourite. It's the one I gravitated to the most, I think probably because it's just so bonkers and out there. However, on secondary kind of viewings, I actually got a lot more of the subtlety of Once Upon a Time. I think you've got, throughout the whole of The Prisoner, it's kind of got that framework of how's he going to try and escape this week? How is the village going to try and break him? And I think you needed that bridge from those kind of weekly episodes up to the finale, going into the finale. And I just think watching it back, they couldn't have done Once Upon a Time any better to serve that purpose. I think it's a really good bridging episode to kind of connect everything up and set it up perfectly for the finale. So I think it's definitely over time I've appreciated Once Upon a Time more. I think it's definitely my favorite one of the whole run, I think.
Actually, you know what? You see, Luke, this is why you're so often in charge. We do ask two questions, and I've asked them in the wrong order.
Well, that's fine.
Usually, we start off under your guidance by saying, hey, The Prisoner, what brought you to The Prisoner? Why are you a big fan of The Prisoner? And of course, I just go, yeah, let's just jump straight to the second part. So, I apologise for that. The Prisoner, what first got you into The Prisoner?
I think it was 2001 I first watched it. I was at university at the time, and I was getting into quite a lot of the other kind of 60s shows like The Avengers, The Saint, things like that. And I suppose just from watching those, it was kind of an organic progression really into The Prisoner. I didn't know much about it, so I kind of asked kind of my parents sort of who I know watched it when it was on originally. My mum wasn't very much help. She just referred to it as that weird show with the big ball, which kind of intrigued me, I must admit. Anything slightly out of the ordinary, TV, music, theatre, film, whatever, I'm there. So that really piqued my interest. So yeah, there was definitely that. I mean, it was when I kind of watched it the first time, the Sci-Fi Channel on Sky were showing reruns of it, and I don't know how many times offhand, how many times it's been repeated, but my mum kind of noticed it, and she said, how about I record it for you, send it up to you while you're at uni, and you can watch it that way, because, you know, penniless student, didn't have Sky, anything like that. So I actually watched The Prisoner over a period of about a year and a half, I think, the first time round, because I was getting three episodes on a VHS tape every month, which I'd then watch and send back, ready for the next three to be recorded. So it was a very piecemeal approach to kind of viewing it. But I think in the kind of days we've got now where we can binge everything, it was a really good way of getting it, because it forced you to kind of cogitate it or digest it, if you will, each episode, and really kind of ruminate on it. And my housemate actually at the time loved The Prisoner. He was an absolute obsessive of it, and he said, you know, if there's ever a point in it where you feel like you kind of lose an interest, stick with it to the end, because you will love the ending. You know, you're that type of person. You will actually love the last episode. So stick with it right to the end. And I mean, even from watching Arrival, you know, I was hooked. It was the real intrigue of it. The fact you don't know anything about any of the characters in it. Who is this guy? What did he do? Why is he there? You know, that was so many questions. And I mean, it's famously a series that doesn't give much away. And you do have to invest a lot in it as a viewer. That's not to say, I mean, there's ways of means of watching it. You can watch it as a very formulaic kind of TV serial. You know, it's what you take from it. You can take it as an adventure kind of romp where this guy's been kidnapped and has to escape. Or you've got a lot of the kind of metaphorical images, you've got a lot of the surrealism, you've got all these concepts of self, of conformity, which, you know, if you want to drill down and watch it on that level, I think it works for everyone. So it was that. I never had a TV series really that offered so much back to the viewer, I don't think. And that really kept me hooked and wanted to watch the rest of it. So that was really my kind of into it. Back in the day, and obviously from there I kind of got the whole series on DVD before, you know, I got the repeats on tape, Blu-ray obviously from there, and yeah, that's that was kind of my way into it.
Can I just make a stupid aside at this point? And
always,
oh, there we go. That's for those of the younger listeners, that's the sound of a VHS tape being opened, and I happen to have a VHS tape. I mean, I love that, Peter, because, I mean, I've talked on previous episodes about the fact that I originally watched the series on VHS. Those were kind of the tapes you could buy in the shops in the 90s, yeah, when they collected. But yeah, there's just something about having watched it on VHS, then got the DVD. I don't know, have you seen the Blu-ray, or are you still on DVD?
No, they've got the 50th anniversary Blu-ray with the full kind of library music soundtrack, so it's the full bells and whistles, and yeah, that's what strikes me. It's absolutely pristine. It could have been made yesterday. It is ridiculous how well a transfer it is. You know, it's I mean, you can watch a film from 5-10 years ago, it looks absolutely shocking on Blu-ray, but the job they've done on it is fantastic, I have to say. It's it really is a sterling job.
Yeah,
I was watching the one of those reality TV shows, and it was filmed in Port Merion, and it was interviewing the people who actually live there now. One of the guys who works there was saying he uses the Blu-ray as reference material when they're choosing the paint colours for the house, because obviously it's a listed building, so everything has to be pristinely recreated at the time it was turned into a listed building. Yeah. So it's so good, the Blu-ray. I just love it. Although, to be fair, I'm watching the DVD transfer as MP4s on my phone. So, you know, to imagine you could watch The Prisoner on a screen this big and just have it anywhere with you is so good.
And having recently edited the early part of our podcast, I can tell you that Michael told that same anecdote in episode one for Arrival.
So it's 2 years in.
Well, this is the thing. We are recording this over a year and a half after we started this odyssey.
There's going to be a lot of editing going on in this episode. I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. I'll keep it in, Michael. It's fine. Oh, okay. It's funny. yes, we do have another question, Michael. But Peter has already started to answer the question.
Stop interrupting and let him get on with
fine.
It.
No, it's fine. Which is how do you interpret the show?
Yeah.
But you'd already started to kind of talk about that, Peter.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think it's, like I said, it's on many levels that you can really take it away. And whether it's, I mean, I like to kind of, I've always overanalyzed things, my wife would probably say, but I think it's, I mean, ultimately, I think the takeaway message or a moral, if there is one in The Prisoner, I think is kind of be yourself. It's that desire to remain an individual. Don't be conformist. Don't go along with the flock. Retain your spirit at all costs. And I mean, even in the last episode where they and we're not here to specifically talk about that, but when the supervisor takes number six down, he says, "We think you'd feel more comfortable as yourself." I think that's the thing. It's, and it can apply to any walk of life, really. That's that kind of you know, stand up for yourself. Don't be one of the sheep, sort of thing, and really stand out. You know, and I think that's definitely come to the fore a lot more in recent years. I don't know consider that was in the late 60s when they made the series, but obviously we have a lot more acceptance of people now, different sort of creeds, faiths, genders, all that kind of thing as well. So I think sort of be yourself is definitely the takeaway for me from that, and why I like the series so much, and probably Patrick McGoohan's bullishness really in getting the series made. I think there was a lot of opposition, I think, to it. This is not, you know, popular mainstream television. This is going to flop. And it, we look how it's endured. It's over 50 years. And you know, I'm really jealous of people discovering The Prisoner for the first time now. And there's people I recommend it to, and they watch it and they think, I'm so grateful that you showed me this is out there. I would never have found it, you know. And it's that pride, really, that other people are loving it as much as I did, I think. So that's my kind of take on what it kind of means and what it means to me, I think.
Cool.
So shall we dive into this specific episode then?
Yeah.
Because, let me see, I normally watch the episode, make a few notes, bring them here, and that's it. But this is a really special episode because it's kind of a piece of theatre. The velvet backdrops, the fact that everything's in darkness, the pools of light, the way it's shot, the weird character thing. If you saw this on stage, you wouldn't have to change it. It's a perfect piece of theatre.
And it was actually put on, so to interject, I think it was actually put on for the Edinburgh Festival, wasn't it? I think
absolutely wouldn't be surprised at all. So I've got a bit of a theatre background. I've got an OND in theatre production. I worked in a theatre for a bit. I kind of immersed myself in theatre for a long time. But my wife's degree, although she's a head teacher now, is actually in drama. So I wanted to sit down with her and go, right, this is The Prisoner. You've not watched any of the other episodes. What do you think of this one? And then I was kind of ironing and I thought, well, I'll just put it on in the background and see what happens. And I made it the first 9 minutes in, which is the bit before he goes into the, you know, the experimental theatre bit. And I was like, she's not going to get any of this. You really do need to have seen some of the other stuff. Yeah, you can get the basics that, oh, he's in a village, number two's in charge, and he's going to... But until they start hypnotising him, making him regress, and then taking him to this experimental theatre area, that's the bit I think she'd have a trouble with. So I thought, forget that. Let's just stick with us three people who've seen everything. We'll just chat away. So that's where I'm at. But I also texted Luke and I said, so what's this? And you texted me back and said, I've really tried to enjoy this. And what was your reply?
What did I say? I have to read it.
You said something along the lines of, I really tried to enjoy this.
I said, looking forward to the chat. I really tried to like it this time round. I failed.
Fair enough. You see...
I think there was one episode previously... where I pretty much said that to our guest. I hadn't kind of said beforehand, I don't like this episode. I just kind of dropped it on him in the podcast, and then we kind of tried to get him as the guest to explain why it was a great episode. So I mean, I think Michael likes this more than I do.
I think I do,
but I want this episode to be Peter explaining why it's great, and so hopefully I can enjoy it next time.
So why is it great?
Well, interestingly, I mean, it's kind of tacks into what you were just saying there, Michael. I think originally the script editor, when he saw the written script as it was, described it as gibberish, I believe, from when he actually read it. And there was no way this should actually make the final run. It should never have got past the script stage. So I think that's possibly the dialogue more than anything, with the interaction between number six and number two. It is a radical episode. I won't lie. Obviously, what you were saying there, you know, to suddenly foist on the viewing public a piece of probably what is a good 35, 40 minutes of experimental theatre is a brave move. But I think definitely it got appreciation later. I think that, like you say, we wouldn't be talking as much about it if everyone thought the same. I think, you know, it inspires debate. There probably were and are people who are outright hate the episode. But I think as an actual setup for the final episode, to get there from kind of ABC points within the series, I just can't think of a better way of doing it. And that whole kind of regression kind of plot line in there where you're thinking, you know, have they actually finally got him this time? Is this the one that cracks him? That kind of like, I don't know. I remember watching it thinking, I was getting a few episodes in and thinking they're not going to break him. He's the main character. he's going to get out somehow, you know, and things like that. And I do remember thinking that, watching that at various points in episodes. But Once Upon a Time was the one episode I did think, this is it, that, you know, they're going to find out how he resigned, why he gave it all up. And I think that kind of regression, as I say, was a really good thing to put in there, because you're never sure if they have actually managed to succeed or if he's playing them. I think that's the real good aspect. And towards the end of the episode, I think you get more of a feel for that, where he's been kind of stringing them along, possibly, and it's all been a massive, he's turned the game on its head. He kind of knows early on what's going on, what they're trying to do. And I think he's so conditioned to resist that kind of regression that it just hasn't worked. And I think that watching it a second time, knowing that knowledge, I think really adds something to the episode. I think that's a really intriguing sort of second watch kind of thing to put in the back of your head, that he knows all along what they're trying to do and he's going to really play with them.
You know what? That honestly hadn't occurred to me, but it makes a lot of sense right now with you saying that, because when he turns around and he describes, but it's now called Thingy Absolute.
Decree Absolute.
Yeah, Decree Absolute. And the prisoner says that to number two. And number two's already said that to someone else. So it's as if he's aware of the technique in general. But I'd not spotted that until you've just said it now, because I was thinking, right, they've used Hypnolamp, they've done some nursery rhymes, he wakes up, he's a kid, he's got lollipops, he's being pushed around by the butler, the poor butler, in a wheelchair, gets dumped in there, and then they lock the doors and say, right, that's it, we're in here until one of us breaks. And I like the idea. And I know I said in the text, the episode is less than the sum of its parts. And that was a bit of a churlish thing to say, to be honest, because it's incredibly great to watch and let it wash over you. And you're going, oh, yeah, this is just some of the best acting I've ever seen. I have no idea what's going on. But it's just incredibly intense. And I cannot imagine what anybody watching TV would have made of this, because it's like nothing else that's been on. I can think of two examples of TV, three if you count Twin Peaks. I can think of two examples of TV where there's an interrogation scene or a torture scene that's got anything similar to this, and they're both sci-fi. And one of them is Picard being interrogated, saying, you know, there is four lamps, there are five lamps, that business. And the other episode is Sheridan's interrogation in Babylon 5. And that is clearly because, you know, J. Michael loved this episode. So they're the only things that are even remotely akin to this. And they're years later. And they're not even remotely as surreal as this because of the regression. And for me, it's the jump cuts as well. You're just getting somewhere. And when you're watching it, you're like, does the commercial go there or not?
Because
there's one bit where they're really at each other's throats, and then the next second it cuts to them having a whiskey in the corner, and they're chatting as if it's an episode of it's like an episode of Staged, where they cut to what's actually going on rather than the actual narrative you're seeing in front of you, and you're seeing this incredibly intense acting. And I thought the episode may have like skipped a track or something when I was recording it. No, it's exactly like that. It literally just is there, and then it jumps to them going, I should have a chat.
Well, there were a couple of early on. There's a really nice part in there, actually quite a funny part watching it back, which I didn't pick up on the first time, which was the village authorities actually give double time when Degree Absolute kicks in. He actually says double time for the Degree Absolute shift, which I thought is absolutely brilliant. He thought, you know, that would be a thing. And also that the supervisor actually says to number two, I'll be sad to see you go. If he loses, obviously one of them has to die. He'll actually be sad to see him go. And I thought, that's such a sweet thing for him to say, seeing as he's actually outlasted every single number two in the entire episode run.
Yeah.
That was quite a nice sort of touch to put in there. Whether it's intentional or not, I don't know. But I do think that was quite funny watching that back.
Yeah, I mean, so I will say that I like the idea of this episode. You know, I think as a technique to break him, like regressing him to his childhood and then walking him through his life, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And I also think, and we said this when we did Chambers of Big Ben, I think Liam McKern is great. Like, in terms of, like, people to play number two, he's great.
I've never seen a bad performance. I've never seen him in anything where he's less than perfect.
Yeah. So I like the idea. I don't know. I sit there and I watch it and I'm bored. Which bored? I think is like, well, yeah, no, this is, I know. I'm sorry. I'm probably like, Prisoner fans are listening to this going, sacrilege. And I suspect partly, so I watched this one. I think I watched this over a lunchtime. It wasn't even like in the evening. So I wasn't tired. I mean, other than the fact that I am just tired because I'm at that stage of life where small children mean that everything is tired.
That's right. This is a safe space.
We had somebody moan, not moan. Let's not be pejorative.
Feedback.
We had somebody feedback when we were doing the UFO cast that we talked too much about how much we liked our wives, and I was like, well, if that's your only criticism, then I think we're doing a good job. If you want to moan at us for kind of talking about our children, that's equally fine. So there's an element of this time watching it, I'm tired. But then that applies to like every episode of The Prisoner that I've been watching for this podcast. So I don't think I can put it down to that. But and it's not that they aren't two great actors, because they are. And actually, three great actors, because Angelo Muscat plays a great sort of role in this episode as well. He's
underrated in the whole series, I think, especially in this as well.
He's absolutely brilliant in this episode. But I can't lie to you. I just sat there and I was like, I'm not being engaged by this. And I think perhaps possibly this time round, because I know where it's going, you know?
I can see that, yeah.
I think there's an element of that.
So I don't know if in the original run, would people have known this was the penultimate episode? I'm not sure in the listings if it would have said 16 of 17, if you knew that there was another 12 episodes to come after that one. I don't know if that, you know, especially when it was shown originally, if that would have been a factor perhaps. But
I don't know. I think often TV listings do have a kind of so many of so many. But I don't know. I don't know about
there being an odd number of episodes for a series anyway. I don't know if that was another TV
because it was
time.
Made sixth. Which always surprises me. There's a couple of background technical things that really surprise me. Hence the reason that a certain character gets a shave in the next episode, because time had passed. But that's that is why. I don't understand how this can be the sixth episode made. It feels so towards the end. It feels so like they're getting desperate.
But isn't
to
that just because?
Off.
Because he only wanted to make about seven episodes. Like that's the whole thing with McGoohan, is that he only had sort of seven or eight episodes that he wanted to make. And they were like, no, you need to make more to kind of to make it more sellable to the Americans. It was often Lou Grade's thing, wasn't it? Mm. He was like, we need to sell this to the Americans. So I think
this was one of the things that he really would felt like he needed to see.
And obviously we've talked about the fact that there are other episodes where he's credited under a pseudonym, but this is one of the ones where he's credited as himself.
Yeah.
Like this is if this is saying anything, it's saying written and directed by Patrick McGoohan and obviously starring Patrick McGoohan. And I think I've said this before on the podcast, which again is probably sacrilegious. I find it hardest to get on with The Prisoner the most when it's all him. You know, like I'm not a big
when
fan
it,
of
when
free
it's
for,
mainly
for,
his voice.
Yeah, I'm not a really.
That's
I'm not really,
interesting.
I'm not really a big fan of Free for All when we covered that, and I'm not really a fan of this, and I'm not really a fan of Fallout either. Spoilers for next week, though. I haven't rewatched it yet, so maybe when I rewatch it this time before we record next week,
fair,
I'll be like,
I've not rewatched it at all.
No,
but there's a reason. This one I didn't rewatch. I have shoved a DVD on in the background and done other stuff for all of the other episodes. And like I said, every time there's an election, I watch Free For All in the background. It's a kind of a fun thing, right? But with these two episodes, this one and the last one, I have completely avoided them because, for me, this is almost one of the most important episodes of the whole run. It's the one where I think you find out the most about the prisoner himself because the village is using stuff that is clearly from his life to interrogate him with. And mm-hmm. and yes, the argument that you said before about that he's possibly got one over them, he refuses to say the number six all the way through. The childhood counting, McKern's character says six, but the prisoner just goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, stops. McKern says six, and then he goes 7, 8, 9. And it's like, oh, just say six. And he doesn't say six
days
until...
The six are the best, isn't it?
Yeah, six are the best as well.
Give me 12 so I remember. You know, it's little things that have to pick up on that.
That is absolutely brilliant. I know there's like a whole section of my notes, which I couldn't find, dedicated to the school days section, because there's a whole thing about implying that he was a British public school boy, that the boat, the straw hat, the Eton thing going on, the jolly boating, where the music, which, and also the music and the sound effects are on that tape deck. They actually are present as a character. They're not something that we're hearing. There's something they're hearing as well. So that's a beautiful moment. So the school thing with the six of the best, but it's also, you're here at school to learn to behave, to become a member of society, not to obey the rules. And basically you're sitting there going, school is the village. It is setting up society, because society is just an extension of school in order to keep you in your place. Can't you tell that? I'm the headmaster, I'm number two. Because the headmaster is the king of their own domain, but they're answerable to a load of other people that you'll never see. And I was just sitting there going, yeah, that was it. And I think that's one of the reasons the prisoner spoke to me, and this episode spoke to me so much when I was a kid, because that's when I was watching it. I was at school watching these on Channel 4 in the middle of the night.
I think all the phases in that episode do that, though. I mean, I made notes on every one of the stages there. I mean, the sports phase with the boxing, the fencing, building him up and then knocking him down again, goading him that he can't finish the job, he can't kill someone.
Yeah.
Which again is reflected later on when he lies down on the floor and says, kill me, lying on the floor. You know, and McKern can't do it. He's at that stage where the tables have turned so much, and it's that kind of flipping between the two and harking back to earlier lines of dialogue that I really loved in it. And like you say there, the school section, the interview phase, and the jail, the court trial as well, where he's being made to confess to admit to something. You know, it's all those little, almost like Derren Brown, those little kind of tweaks that he's trying to get, auto-suggestion, that trying to get him to slip something. You know, they're just really nuanced, I think, and really subtle.
That court thing, I've written a lot of notes, and basically, right, okay, you want to know why the prisoner resigned. It could be summed up by this, right? The Danger Man character, who isn't this, we're imagining that the prisoner had a career similar to Danger Man. We're not even saying it's the same person. But if you want to go down the he was a spy route, imagine some sort of James Bond car chase. Now, like Doctor Who, there are no consequences in a James Bond film. He does a car chase, he swerves, he kills other people, all of the people, the truck full of chickens just gets out of the way, all of that
market
business.
Market stalls destroyed.
Yeah, market stalls destroyed. The people in the streets never get hurt, but Danger Man character is the anti-Bond, right? So people, like the Ipocres file, people would have got hurt. And I'm imagining there was a car chase, and that's why he can't, that's why he resigns. Innocent people were getting killed, and he didn't want to be part of that anymore, because although he's very good at the job as a whole, seeing how it affects everyone else, I think that's a bit of his actual real life. And he couldn't say, you know, he has a license to kill the enemy. He hasn't got a license to kill random people on the street. So I was actually thinking perhaps that is part of the ongoing narrative of something that actually happened to the prisoner character that might have pushed him towards resigning. So,
well, I'd never spotted
that until this episode.
No. Well, I was wondering, after the jail sort of section that follows that, I often thought how much of it is hiding in plain sight, because if you watch it, he does actually give a reason. He does say he resigns for peace of mind and because he knows too much. So like you said there, if he had actually injured or killed someone, is it for his own conscience he's resigning? Is that I can't deal with this? I've killed people when I shouldn't have. And he knows too much is obviously, I don't know, a reference to, you know, his training, the information he's sort of put along the way. But that obviously isn't deemed a good enough reason by the authorities to allow number two to win decree. Absolutely. He's got to actually get more out of him. He's kind of scratched the surface, but they're wanting him to go a lot deeper, I think. And that, but what you're saying there certainly ties into his actions and his kind of responsibilities in
that role. And it does mess up my other pet theory of him in real life being the person who designed the village, and this is him actually testing the village out. But that was the thing that was wiped from his mind.
So yeah.
which was always my pet theory.
I think we might have hit upon something here.
Okay.
You guys are both really intrigued and interested by his past and by the answer to the question, why did he resign?
Yeah.
I didn't really care about that.
Ah, that does make a lot of sense, yeah.
We have this conversation. You and I, Michael, have this conversation about Doctor Who as well, and I see this discourse online all the time. I don't care what happens before the Doctor meets Ian and Barbara in that junkyard. Okay, I don't want to know. And any moments where Stephen Moffat decided let's have a look at what happened before then, I'm just like, no, the show should never go there. And I think it's that mentality that I bring to this as well. That I'm just like, partly also because I've watched the whole series and I know that we never get a definitive answer to why did he resign. So when you watch it again, you're like, okay, well, I'm never going to get an answer to this question. And so
I quite like that fan theory of the whole, and yeah, I didn't really want to go there, but you have mentioned it on the whole Danger Man versus the prisoner, is it the same character thing? Mm-hmm. I think having that kind of viewing theory kind of works if you want to use that as kind of his backstory. I think, like you say, if you've got no real interest, the prisoner is its own thing. If you want to see, you know, go off and explore his kind of past missions and all that, watch Danger Man or Secret Agent, you know, those sort of episodes to get a feel for that, because like you say, you're not going to get that from the prisoner. It's never truly stated this is canon, this is the real reason he resigned. Obviously that's ambiguous, it's for every viewer to decide, but I think that's kind of a fun little way of kind of exploring that if you want to. I think definitely watching those old late 50s episodes.
I think the other thing in relation to what you just said, Michael, about school, what made school miserable for me were the other pupils.
Yes.
Not the teachers.
Yes.
Or the head teacher. You know, there were teachers that I didn't like, either because of their subject or their demeanour, or both in a couple of cases. But almost, I suppose, my experience of authority in that sense were that the teachers were generally the nice people and the people that I got on with, and many of my fellow pupils were the people that made my life at school miserable. And so
for me, there isn't
quite that direct parallel that you've just drawn. And I can totally see it now that you've just outlined it. I think and it might actually help. Like I say, part of the reason of having this conversation is next time I watch it, maybe I can bring what we've talked about into it and go, okay, right, let's sit down and watch it on the basis of like, this is actually telling us pertinent details about his life. And it's trying to draw parallels between all these things in the village. Because I think what you've both said is really, really interesting and clearly is just bits that I've missed in the past because I haven't been thinking about it in the right way. But yeah, so it just, that parallel wasn't there for me.
Yeah.
But I can certainly see how it is there, and it probably is McGowan drawing on his own.
He has said that this is his most school, you know? Autobiographical of episodes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think because there is parts of that school phase where the teachers aren't, yes, they are authority figures and maybe not there as a figure of kind of hatred, but they're also there to make him feel safe, to kind of lull him into that false sense of security, you know, especially you've got the childhood phase before that, but also teach, kind of introducing him in character, if you will, to that kind of conformist attitude. So it's not really, I'm here to scare you into telling me what you know, why you resigned. It's more, you know, trust me, I'm here to make you feel safe. I am the nice person. Why don't you tell me, you know, tell me why you resigned. You know, we can help you and all that. That kind of good cop, bad cop, that's turning on its head. So that's kind of, yeah, another cool way of looking at it, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, but just getting back to school, you're beyond right. I think about school and in an experience of school, because with teachers, almost uniformly, you know where you stand. You know where you stand with the head. You know where you stand because they have a definitive place in the society.
Yeah.
The chaotic elements of being at school are always going to be the other children because you are one of them, but you are never one of them, ever. You are always the individual. You're always number six because you are the hero of your own story. You never know what them other kids' motivations are. And because you're a kid, you're often quite insular and you don't care what other people's insulations, other motivations are, because you're not them. Your level of empathy kind of... You can have a lot of empathy when you're a kid, but it can grow as you get older.
Yeah.
And so I can see the other side of that. I can see why you wouldn't think that about the village as a, as an example of school as well. But I don't think that's what McGowan was getting at.
No, yeah. I think, like I say, I think it's, and I think you said this earlier, Peter, it's what you bring and take and...
Well, yeah.
You know, and that's not a very original observation. We do that with media, but I think it's worth restating, as you did. And yeah, and I just, that, I mean, I suppose it's part of, another digression here. It's one of the reasons why I've not watched Class, the Doctor Who spin-off. Because I was just like, it's a Doctor Who spin-off set in secondary school, right? Why would I want to watch a Doctor Who spin-off set in secondary school?
There's an even more obvious example of that, especially from my childhood, because I was of the very era to do that. Grange Hill. Why would I come home from school and watch a programme about school? What's the point? Right? Peter Davison's Doctor Who's on in a bit. I'll be watching that instead. Bit of escapism from the torture and the pointlessness of school. Right? And why could you go home and go, oh, and they were just so unrelatable, because that was not, sorry, I'm sounding like Morrissey lyrics, but it says nothing to me about my life, and it didn't. So Class is a series. Okay, I've enjoyed some of the episodes from Big Finish, right? But that's mainly because I've approached them as, you know, continuing audio drama. But on TV, I just couldn't get it. And yet, anyone who's listened to my podcast knows that I preferred Sarah Jane Adventures, which was kids, to Doctor Who at the time. I would really genuinely be excited to watch a new episode of Sarah Jane way over watching the episode of Doctor Who that was on about the same time, and considerably more than watching Torchwood, because it spoke to me. And that was kids. And in Torchwood, it was just people pretending to be adult and swearing and having sex. And it was like, yay, great. Bring on the aliens. And Sarah Jane was just like, and here's this week's aliens, right? And we're going to take it on, because that's what I'm there for. I'm there for the aliens. I don't care about anything else. And so I'm sorry, I'm lost again, as always.
Are we really saying that we wouldn't watch a Prisoner spin-off featuring, say, the maids who clean the apartments out? That would be a bad idea if they made something like that.
Well, yeah.
No, I mean, yes. I think that's a relevant point, that with spin-offs is they're talking about Doctor Who spin-offs now, and I'm just like, no, just make more Doctor Who. And I would be like, with The Prisoner, be like, no, I wouldn't want a Prisoner spin-off. I just want more episodes of Patrick McGowan doing stuff, you know, like more escape episodes, more the village is trying to break him, more he tries to break the village. You know, those are the kind of various.
I wonder if there's, especially with what you said, Luke, about the episodes that McGowan wrote and directed himself. I mean, I wonder how much of an element of kind of control freak there is about that, because we touched very briefly a while back on Twin Peaks. Not to go off on too much of a tangent, but...
No, God, please, that's what we're here for.
I mean, watching Twin Peaks, I mean, I remember that very vaguely from when I was, you know, when it was on originally, I would have been about 10 or 11, so a lot of it went over my head. But watching it back as an adult, I mean, I much prefer the David Lynch written and directed episodes to the ones, especially in series two of Twin Peaks, which just went off to kind of rent a writer, and it turned almost into a soap opera, you know, things like that. So I think that the creator of the show having that kind of creative control, I think, is quite important in places, and especially, like you say, for these last two episodes of The Prisoner, McGowan had a vision of where it had to be. I mean, however slapdash the last episode kind of feels, you know, in terms of how he wrote it, I think he wrote it very rushed on the way back while they were making this series, while they were filming it. But I think having that control from the person who's actually come up with it, I think in a lot of projects is very important. And obviously he had a way forward he wanted to go, and he stuck to that. That's part of my admiration for him and the series. That it was, he did it his way, screw everybody else, basically.
which is totally fine. It got made because McGowan had this idea, and he wrote bits and he directed bits and everything. And J. Michael Straczynski, the point where he was writing every episode of Babylon 5 is the strongest bit of Babylon 5. Like,
yes.
So I agree with you that, like, it can work really, really well. And all I can say is that for me, and maybe this is just because, I don't want to say that I'm a simple soul, but I just prefer the more straightforward episodes or the more light-hearted episodes, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a matter of taste.
That's what you want. Yeah.
And taste is very subjective, so that's fine.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's interesting. You talked about you encountered the prisoner as a student.
Mm-hmm.
I encountered the prisoner as a child. I mean, sort of. I probably started watching pre-teen, when we talked about this before. And so I don't think it's a particular surprise that episodes like this one, which are more cerebral and adult, would have left me cold when I first saw them. And so I've started with a lasting impression of what this episode is. And I obviously, as I said to Michael, I came to it wanting to like it because it's an episode of The Prisoner. We're doing this podcast, you know. So it wasn't like I didn't try. But
yeah.
I think there's a lot of weight of past perception and experience.
Yeah, but if you have to try to like something, you've already lost the argument.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. Well, exactly. So, and it's not like I avoid it, you know.
The great thing about The Prisoner is that there are so many varied episodes. You've got kind of the real kind of wacky ones like Living in Harmony and The Girl Who Was Death, which are just totally, you know, sort of the not even prisoner episodes, really, or the Do Not Forsake Me, My Darling, where, you know, McGowan isn't even in it, you know, things like that. And you've got the very, I wouldn't say straightforward, but like Many Happy Returns, where it is actually an escape episode, or Chimes of Big Ben, where you think, oh, whoa, wait a minute, we're really early into the series here and he's escaped. What's going on? You know, it's that kind of throws you a little bit. So there's loads of different varied sort of episodes, or like these Battle of Wills ones, like Once Upon a Time or Hammer into Anvil, which are these real psychological to-ing and fro-ing, which, you know, can be quite heavy and, as Luke said, quite intense episodes. But also, I think there's a lot more, you know, kind of like you say, straightforward ones, which are there. You can just put them on and enjoy them. You know, you haven't really got to think if you don't want to. You can just enjoy it for being an action romp with a bit of a sci-fi edge. I think that's, you know, if you really want to sort of disturb down.
I think it's interesting that you just drew a parallel with Hammer into Anvil, though. Because I really love Hammer into Anvil. It's one of my favourite episodes of the series. I think maybe that the obvious difference between the two is that Hammer into Anvil is funny, right? Like, it's laugh out loud funny, and Once Upon a Time is just deadly serious.
Yeah,
you know. And I think what you guys have done in talking about it has led me to kind of go, okay, now there is lots of good stuff in it. Like the dialogue, I agree. The dialogue is great. There's some really interesting stuff. And I don't think I'd quite picked up on... I mean, obviously, I didn't miss the fact that he refused to say six, but I hadn't realised quite how much of a thread that was. And also, I never even considered the idea that he might have been aware of what was going on all along, you know? I've just always kind of read it, okay, they've regressed him, and it's just as he kind of gets back to kind of being an adult, he finally figures out what's going on. But actually, I think your suggestion is that maybe the regression fails and that he's just stringing them along all the time. Yeah.
The other part I liked about it was the fact that you're introduced to a new part of the village that you've not seen before. As Michael was saying, the experimental theatre room, you don't know that exists up until episode 16, which I think is a really good little plot, that sort of twist there. A bit like in, and again, just touching on another series, sort of like in Lost, which I know got a bit derided for the way it ended, but when they kind of introduced kind of like the hatch underneath the island, you've got this whole new section that just opens up a whole new sort of part of the show, you know, and in The Prisoner. And although it's only used for the one episode, it makes you wonder if they had put more episodes in, how many other little secret areas you would have come across, and this kind of underground labyrinth, does it expand further than that? It's that I just thought was really good to put that in there. There's places that existed all along and you've not seen it up until that point, but it suddenly appears and it has a purpose. You know, it's really great.
I've got two questions. Well, one question with two parts. Right, I've been reading up on this and I've heard two separate stories. One of them is that Patrick McGowan was ill during the filming of this, and he's actually got his body double is in quite a few shots. Now, it's a three-hander. Well, it's a two-hander and somebody being all waiting for Godot and standing around, like, you know, with the rattle and the really cool shades for the butler. But if McGowan's not in this because he was exhausted, because he'd written it and was trying to direct at the same time and had a few days off in the middle, I can't tell. But then there's also the story in some of the other reference books that McKern had a breakdown halfway through this as well. And A, are either of those stories true, or was it just a couple of actors turning up for work, getting on with it, it was a bit of a drain, they finished it, it was done? Or are these stories real? Because, yes, it looks intense, but I've sat in a theatre and watched an hour and a half, a two-hour performance of Waiting for Godot, of something as dark or as intense as this, live. And the actors afterwards just, you know, they bow, they clap, they go off stage, they have a gin and tonic, they go home. And they were doing that every single night. This is a one-off. They get it right once for the recording, and then that was just too draining. So are these stories true? Has anybody else heard them?
I vaguely remember the McKern story, that there was some kind of incident, I don't know, like about a bout of ill health or something. Not the McGowan one, I must say, but I vaguely remember, now you've said that, something in the back of my mind sort of says, yeah, he had some sort of episode or something, which I don't know, as you say, I mean, he's one of the main actors in it, so he couldn't really have taken the time off. But I mean, if he was kind of ill for any reason, would that maybe have kind of added to the performance, you know, especially towards the end of it, where they're absolutely run ragged, they're mentally and physically drained, they're fighting, you know, and one of them's gonna die. If you're kind of looking a bit peaky, that would certainly fit in with the episode filming, you know, the fact that the state McKern is in character at the end of the episode, where he's just done. And he kind of almost admits defeat, you know, that the clock's ticking down. He knows he's not going to get a confession or an admission of why he resigned out of him. I think that would have played into the filming of it, I think, in terms of his physical condition. But no, as to whether it's true or not, I don't know. I've never found anything about that, so I can't really comment.
I have no doubt that any of the various experts that we have listening to the show will be writing in at this point to let us know.
See, this worries me, because we've got actual experts listening now, because we've started with the because the original plan was to record the 17, 18, 19 episodes, however many we ended up doing beforehand, before we ever started releasing them. But they're actually out in the wild now. I think episode three comes out tomorrow.
Episode three comes out on the UFO feed.
And we are one episode off finishing the whole thing on TV anyway. I mean, if we do the 2009
do the remake.
I might do it myself, right? We might do that, but we might do Big Finish, right? Because that actually makes more sense.
Yes, but I still haven't listened to Big Finish, so that
we'll do that down the line, four or five years' time.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's beside the point. We're one episode off finishing the TV run. And it's out there in the wild, and people have got opinions about the things we've said, and it's a bit weird, because for so long it's just been me, Luke, and whoever we could get in, our guest number three, who usually has much more of an opinion on the show than either of us and is much more educated on it, telling us stuff. But now other people are going, well, I think you'll find this. And I'm like, whoa.
No, I think any feedback we've had thus far has been gentle and... Not in a kind of like, you got this wrong, but more just like, here's some extra information, which...
Nah, that's...
A real fan. Well, any real fan would know this.
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody who's listened to the podcast thus far will know that neither of us are deeply entrenched into the fandom. I think that's in the way that we both have been at various points into Doctor Who fandom. I've just always been a fan of The Prisoner, and it's only really doing this podcast that I've even connected with Prisoner fans beyond you, Michael, really. And that's been great, because we've had people on who've written books about The Prisoner, and I'm sitting there going, oh, I feel remarkably unknowledgeable at this point. And we, as a podcast, we don't claim to be an authority on The Prisoner. We're just two fans who like it, who are getting other fans on to talk about it, and we hope that these conversations are...
We know our place. We're fine. But yeah. we are. That's exactly what we are. We're fans of The Prisoner, and we want to share that with other people. And yeah. that's exactly what we've done. And I've had an absolute blast doing this. I really have. So, Misi, now, normally, I don't know, does anybody have any more things that they need to share about this specific episode?
Covered most things, I think. There was one really jarring thing, which I think happens right at the start of the episode, which I don't know how much to read into it, is when McKern comes back as number two up on the little elevated platform that brings him into the office, and he's obviously very unhappy to be brought back. The fact Rover's sat in his chair, I love that. Just that complete, no context whatsoever.
And on the Blu-ray, you can see it shaking with rage.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that. Just, why is it there? Is it, do they not trust him? You know, and he's absolutely pissed off about it as well, looking at it. Why is this thing here? I'm not an inmate, I think he says. But it's absolutely real, just almost like a little in-joke. Let's just put Rover, he's not in this episode. Let's give him a bit of time to shine. Really like that when that happened.
I think it's interesting, actually, and that relates to what we were just saying about feedback. So my brother's just listened to episode one, and he sent me a message, which I will just find, because I think it's pertinent to what you just said. And it links all the way back to Arrival. So he says, rewatching Arrival, I had the thought that when number six says, "Who brought me here?" and the first number two replies, "I know how you feel, believe me," they have taken quite a liberty. If that is taken literally, then in his past, this number two was kidnapped and taken to the village, and he then became one of those who leave this place. You know, so, and I'd never really thought about that. I thought that line was kind of, he's just being patronising, going, "I know how you feel," you know. But actually, that could be setting up this idea of actually, and what you just said about Liam McKern being brought back, is that, and I guess we see this with other number twos like Colin Gordon in A, B, and C, who's kind of at the end of his tether. You kind of feel, oh, what happens to him afterward? I mean, obviously he comes back in the general, but you know, orders and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
But the idea that like certain number twos are, and the one who's going to retire in It's Your Funeral, like these people are all puppets of a higher power, aren't they? And they're equally victims of the village, as it were. And we get more of, I think we can have slight spoilers for Fallout now.
I think
at this
can,
point in the series. But in case you are watching The Prisoner for the first time and you're waiting to watch Fallout until after you listen to us talk about it, we do get more of McKern's story next week. Don't we? So,
which is weird. Oh, sorry, there's a bit I missed. And it was that McKern, the clock counts down to zero, and McKern just falls over dead. There's no reason. There's no bullet. There's no poison. He's just like, hits the ground. That's it. And I found that weird. I had to rewind the video, rewind the disc to make sure that is what happens.
Clock, I think it's more zero. A dramatic kind of interlude, isn't it? With his heartbeat and the clock, and then it just stops and he just falls down. It's just a brilliant sort of moment of television, really. But like you say, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever in a real medical sense. It's,
and I just wanted somebody else's input, yeah.
That's just reminding me, again, I've just got another weird theory. But so when he introduces the whole thing, and this is one of the lines that's on the soundtrack album from, like, the ones they released 20 years ago. So I'm very familiar with the line where he goes, "Neither of us can leave until death us do part." Right? Which obviously is a line from the wedding
vows. The
marriage
vows, yeah.
Right? You know, like, you said you were married, Peter, right? We have all made these vows to somebody, you know? And it's weird to hear them in this context. Like, because anybody watching that episode...
Adding to that as well, I mean, if you look at degree absolute, you've got decree absolute, which is a divorce, which is it number six divorcing himself from the village? You've got that tying into the marriage vows as well. It all links in.
Yeah, but it's
odd.
If you think about it, it's kind of weirdly setting up this relationship between number six and number two.
Of course, going into Fallout, there's them eloping as well, which, just not to give too much away, but you know, it's running away together, which is quite a nice image there. But it's definitely just little things that are said,
and I suppose, I don't know, my reading of that was simply that by initiating this process, that there's something about being locked in that room. There's some like actual process that the village puts in place whereby one of them will die.
But
equally, we've been told throughout the series that number six is too important to break, which means he's definitely too important to kill. Which adds another level to the whole thing of like going, oh well, hang on, like, because number two is the one that goes, okay, you've brought me back, so I'm going to do it my way, and my way is this, right? And it's weird that he would submit himself to a process whereby death is the penalty for the loser, and yet he knows how important number six is to the village.
He knows he's going to keep being brought back, and he kind of wants to die in a way. He knows this is an endless cycle he's locked into, and the only way out is I'm going to go in, I'm going to submit myself to this, and I'm going to lose. You know, I know deep down in my heart that number six is more than a match for me. I know this is my only way out of the village. You know, maybe that's it.
Is it that they've got more desperate,
and they need,
or is it that they've reached the end of their tether and they need to break him, and they've gone like, well, we need the information, but obviously that's got a finite amount of time, so we need to break him now, and we need to do that. Is it, or is it more like a THX 1138 thing where they've only got a certain amount of budget to get the information out, and they've become so desperate to the point where they just go, right, it's now not worth it.
Yeah, we need to either get it or kill him. That's just done.
All sorts of possibilities there.
And also, I mean, has anybody actually, I don't know if anything's been done with this, how long he's actually in the village for? Obviously, it's 17 episodes, but in terms of a time span, I don't think there's a way watching the series you can figure out how long he's actually in there. Is it months or years? I don't know.
We know from Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, that at the beginning of that episode, they wipe a year's worth of memories from his head. So that he wakes up, as far as he's concerned, he wakes up the day after Janet's previous birthday.
Yes.
And then when he meets her, he discovers that it's been a year. So we know that at some point after Janet's previous birthday and this next one, he gets taken to the village. We don't know how long that is. But I think
so.
I
as
think
a rule of thumb, we could quite easily imagine that each episode happens over a period that fits into our month.
Yeah.
Well, we know that Schizoid Man takes place over the length of time it takes for a bruise to grow out of his thumb.
Yeah,
true.
Which we worked out when we did that episode. I can't remember how long it was, but that's a period of time.
You did as well.
I mean, you could apply that to any series. I mean, like the Simpsons. How many episodes of the Simpsons take place in a week? You know, I mean, how many seasons are there of the Simpsons, and how many episodes? It's ridiculous that they don't age. You know,
Bart is 10, and there's more than 360 episodes. So therefore, every episode needs to happen in one day.
So I think we can't really say because
Andy was conceived in 1982.
It's also like Jennings is always in the third form, and there are like enough books to kind of, because each book takes maybe like a term, there are enough books to get him through the whole of his schooling, and yet he never gets beyond the third form. How does that work?
Just
William never grows up.
Okay, well, my notes are done. I promise you.
Yeah, no, I think I'm exhausted as well.
So, normally at this point, we do spot the Doctor Who actor. Now, there is a... We've already covered Angelo Muscat, because he's been in lots of episodes before. There is a guy in the credits whose scenes are deleted, who was in Doctor Who, but we've already covered him because he's already been in the show. That was John Maxim, who was in A Change of Mind, I think it was. But his scenes are deleted. He's in the credits, but his scenes are deleted. So there is nobody to spot this week, Michael. Unfortunately for you. We'll have to play it again next week. I'm not sure about Fallout either, actually.
There's got to be something. If not, is there not a 6 degrees of separation you could play with somebody from that episode, maybe?
Obviously, you've got Angelo Muscat So Angelo Muscat always gets you back to Doctor Who. I looked him up the other day. He had such a sad life.
He died quite young, didn't he? Well, not an old man.
Wasn't too long after this.
He died in his 40s, I think. Yeah. Penniless, basically.
Yeah.
But there's a society who meet every year to celebrate his life, which I thought was quite sweet, at least according to the Wikipedia page.
Should have a statue of him in Port Merion, I think.
I think I need to join. That would be nice.
That'd be beautiful. Pushing McGurn in a wheelchair with an ice cream.
I think just there with a tray, as the butler outside the green door.
With the plaque underneath, it says, "The coffee, leave it."
I'll tell you what, he puts in a great performance and he moves so much furniture throughout this whole thing. He's just the unsung hero. He's a powerhouse. Yeah. Oh, did anyone else notice the rocking horse is never pushed and it never stops rocking in the entire episode? It's just constantly going. I've only got it on in the background as we record this and I'm looking up going, why is the rocking horse still moving? There must have been some poor stagehand going, and start the rocking horse, and we're rolling, begin.
A fishing wire, just keep pulling it.
No Doctor Who, people. Yeah, go on.
I was going to say, this is entirely an aside. I was once involved in cigarette continuity for a short film one or two characters in this scene were smoking cigarettes. And we shot it from various angles at various points. So we kept on having to kind of have him stub out a cigarette and then go, right, your cigarette was this long before we started, so we need to give you another. I don't know how, I think he got through about five or six cigarettes, which were just one cigarette in the final edit.
Because cigarette continuity is a nightmare, especially when you see it actually in a TV show. Especially for the 70s cop dramas, they were obviously smoking their own stuff. Yeah. And they're like little trombones going on. A big, long, short. My wife is appallingly bad for spotting stuff like that. She'll turn to me and just go, "Well, did you see that?" And I'll be going, "No," and she'll be like, "Well, that woman's hair reverses the partings on one side, then it's on the other side."
The worst one that I've only noticed in the last few years, and I can't now unsee it, is kissing reverse angles. So if you think about it, right, if you see a couple kissing from one angle. Right? Because one person is leaning one way and one person leaning the other way, right? So if you shoot it from that way, you'll see the one person's face, right? If you shoot it from the other angle, you shouldn't be able to see the other person's face because they're on the other side. But you always can in the reverse angle.
Good point.
Love moves in mysterious ways.
And so I was just like, how have I not noticed this before? And then every single film I now see a couple kissing and they kind of go from one angle to the other. You're just like, no, that doesn't work. You flip to the side that you're... Yeah,
right.
Anyway.
Well, I think that was one of our best digressions of all time. So, we probably haven't convinced you that this episode was better than you thought. But
no,
we have given you more stuff
best,
to consider when you watch it again.
No. What you have done, I mean, Peter, you've done a great job of explaining why you like it, which I've really enjoyed your perspective. And you've both done a great job of saying, have a think about the episode in this way.
Yeah.
Which means that the next time when I get round to watching it, and I mean, it's going to be a while before I watch The Prisoner again now, because there's so much other stuff to watch and waffle about. But the next time I get round to it, I think I will come back to this conversation and go, okay, right, this is what's going to help me to appreciate it afresh next time.
I, for one, prefer this one to next week's, but that we're going to have to wait to discuss next time. So, Peter, where can we find you on the internet?
I'm on Facebook. That's probably the only place I'm actually at the moment. I had a little bit of a purge, I won't lie. I do have an Instagram account. I've got some of my poetry books are actually on Amazon at the moment under my writing name PT Musket, if anyone wants to check those out. There's no prisoner related poetry. I will put that out there right now.
Yet.
But you know, not yet, no. That could be a thing. I could write a poem about every episode, maybe, but that's one to pursue. But yeah, if poetry is your thing, dark humour and other odd things, do go and check that out. And I'd be more than grateful if anyone does. But I'm on Facebook, so if anyone wants to add that and have more prisoner chat, I'd be more than up for that.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for being our number three this week.
Thank you very
much. So I'm guessing I should really sign off then in the traditional fashion.
You should, Michael. I will say goodbye and leave the final word to you.
Thank you. Until next time. be seeing you